There is a joke they tell in China about President Donald Trump's upset victory in 2016. And we learned about it from our intern, Echo Wang. She is from China. Hi, Echo.
Hi.
And the joke is about a province in China where they make flags. So, Echo, tell us, what is this joke?
Yes, it's a province called Zhejiang, and people there, they thought that they were the first in the world to know that Trump was going to win because they got way more flag orders from Trump campaign than from Clinton's campaign.
Oh, so they were making flags for political rallies, and they got so many more orders for Trump flags than Hillary flags, they knew he was going to win.
Yep.
Li Zhang owns a flag-making factory in this province. It was, in fact, one of the places that was making Hillary Clinton flags and Donald Trump flags back in 2016. And he doesn't just make political flags. He makes flags for countries all over the world, including the U.S. He says he's made flags for all 50 states.
Mr. Li does not speak English, so we asked Echo to translate for us.
How many flags do you make? Do you know?
Every day around 100,000.
That is so many flags.
Yes.
Li Zhang's factory is big and open, and the flags are on these giant spools, these big fabric rolls that are just flag after flag after flag. And workers cut them apart and sew the side seam. It's amazing to watch. They're super fast.
Mr. Li says he makes a ton of little flags, those 4-inch by 6-inch flags, like the ones that people were waving earlier this week at 4th of July parades. The biggest flag he's ever made was for a mega skyscraper in the United Arab Emirates that was more than 160 feet across.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Cardiff Garcia, and we are the hosts of The Indicator, Planet Money's daily podcast.
And in case you didn't know, it is summer. It is hot. It is a holiday week. Happy late 4th of July, Cardiff Garcia.
Yeah, and to you. We're not actually here right now.
No.
We're enjoying our holidays.
Not in spirit.
Pre-taped.
Today on the show, we bring you two summer-themed episodes from our podcast. First, flags. As it turns out, they are a really fascinating indicator. They can help you predict an election, and they can also tell you a lot about global trade.
And second, we call up a barn in Iowa that has gotten caught up in a national trend. There used to be a lot of teenagers working in the summers. Now, the teenagers are gone.
Where are the teens?
Yeah.
Playing Xbox.
What's going to happen
new character.
If somebody wants to do like a sequel to Fast Times at Ridgemont High? How are they going to do it without teenage employment?
Baby boomers.
What? That would be such a great movie.
I would go see that movie.
What happens when the summer jobs go away? Stick around.
Support for Planet Money and the following message come from SimpliSafe, home security done right. The New York Times Wirecutter calls SimpliSafe the best home security. SimpliSafe is thoughtfully designed so you can blanket your home with protection and never notice it. There are no contracts, and CNET, The Wirecutter, and PC Mag all name it their top pick for home security. Over 2 million people use it every day. Learn more about how SimpliSafe can help you today. Go to simplisafe.com/planetmoney.
Hey, Asma.
Hey, Scott.
Another crazy week. We've got North Korea.
Yep, we got Russia.
Midterms.
And, of course, President Trump. And what happens whenever there is crazy news that erupts? We pop into the studio and break it down to make sense.
So if you see a headline,
we've discussed it.
It's the NPR Politics Podcast.
We caught up with Mr. Li in his car on his way home from dinner. He had just gone out with his wife and some friends. Oh, what did you have in town?
You know, shrimps and rice. We think Chinese food is really good.
So do I. See, we're just building bridges here at the Indicator.
Yeah. Who doesn't think Chinese food is really good?
And we were talking with Mr. Li about his flag factory, and he told us that, in fact, his factory did not always make flags.
We were actually producing these red scarves for primary school students, the young pioneers.
The young pioneers are like the Communist Party youth. And in fact, Mr. Li's factory is called We Must Win from that time.
But then in 2001, China joined the World Trade Organization, which made it easier for the country to trade with the rest of the world. And Mr. Li and his wife saw this chance to grow their business, to go global themselves. And literally, like, what is more global than flags?
Nothing is more global than flags.
So Mr. Li started making flags for countries all around the world.
We're producing a lot of flags, for example, from Germany, France, Brazil, United Kingdom, India, South Africa.
Mr. Lee's factory and the inexpensive labor in his country meant his business quickly became competitive on a global scale. He started charging about a dollar per flag, making about a dime of profit on each one. And business has been growing pretty consistently with the world and with the U.S., at least for now.
Yeah, the U.S.'s trade war with China has not yet directly affected Mr. Lee and his business. There are no flag tariffs yet. But President Trump's escalating trade tensions with China do worry Mr. Lee. And those tensions are especially notable to him, considering one of the orders that he is currently filling.
We also make flags for Trump for 2020. It seems like he has another campaign going on in 2020. Isn't that right?
That's right. Do the flags say made in China on them?
Yes, all of them.
So, Cardiff, as you know, a lot has been made of Trump's Make America Great Again hats being made in China. But the fact is, even though Trump has kicked off what is shaping up to be a full-on trade war with China, the guy needs flags and Make America Great Again hats for his campaign. Thousands of them. And if you need thousands of flags and hats in a short span of time at a reasonable price, you go to China. Does it feel strange to be making flags for him?
It is completely normal. That is trade. We buy stuff from America and America is buying stuff from China. For example, my car is from America.
Oh, what kind of car do you have?
It's a BMW X5.
Oh, wow, nice car.
And the wife said that it is from Germany. But he said, no, I know that it is from a branch of BMW based in America.
And in fact, they do make BMWs in Spartanburg County, South Carolina. BMW moved part of its production there in the 1990s, and the factory employs about 9,000 workers, and they had been planning a big expansion. But recently, they have threatened to close the plant if President Trump puts a tariff on European cars, which he said he just might do.
You like the car?
Very much. Look, this is the best car from Germany, and they're producing from America. Of course, I like it.
This is incredible, by the way. I just want to note that, right? He makes flags, the symbol of a country's pride, which he sends to America, which makes the car that he drives, but which was designed in Germany. And not to mention it, he's also talking to us on an iPhone 7, designed in the U.S., made in China.
And he's on his way back to a factory where he's busily filling an order for thousands of blue and white Trump 2020 flags, supporting the campaign of a man who has been speaking out against businesses like his.
You can imagine a situation where in the future, when President Trump is campaigning again for himself or maybe for some other people, that he'll be looking out over a sea of supporters and they'll be waving flags and wearing hats that were just shipped in from China and which are affordable to give out en masse, in part because of the very system that President Trump is now condemning.
And Mr. Lee's flags might eventually end up on a U.S. tariff list. Are you worried about a trade war?
We are not so worried because, first of all, we have a big price advantage over our competitors, and our clients are very smart. They would always go to the cheapest place. If China is cheap, they go to China. If America is cheap, they go to America.
Now, there actually are a lot of American flags made in the U.S., but if you see them at political rallies, you should know that they are the expensive American flags. And we did some searching around. We looked at wholesale prices. And in some cases, American flags made in the U.S. were 3 or 4 or 5 times more expensive than the flags that were made in China.
Right. And this is the thing about free trade, because a U.S.-made American flag is just going to be way more expensive than a flag made in China. And in fact, you see this across the whole textile industry. There used to be a big textile industry in the U.S. up until the 90s, but a lot of that production has moved overseas to Asia. And that has allowed the U.S. economy to grow. It's made way for a booming tech sector and a growing healthcare industry. But it has also left some people behind.
Mr. Lee says even if his U.S. business disappears entirely, he'll be fine. Most of his business is with other countries. Lots of orders lately, in particular, from Israel, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia. And mostly, Mr. Lee says, it would just mean that he wouldn't be making any more U.S. flags. And for U.S. consumers, it would mean either fewer flags or more expensive flags at political rallies and at 4th of July parades.
I mean, you have to look at flags all the time. How do you think it compares to other flags looks-wise?
It's very pretty, with stars and stripes. 50 stars, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
51 or 50?
50.
50克.
After the break, we bring you our next summer indicator. We send reporter Danielle Kurtzleben on a mission to find out where all the teenage summer jobs have gone.
Support for NPR and the following message come from TransferWise, the cheaper way to send money internationally. TransferWise takes a machete to the hefty fees that come with sending money abroad. Test it out for free at transferwise.com/podcast or download the app.
Would you put on a sweater that once belonged to Hitler? Can Chinese zodiac signs predict who's going to be a great scientist? And what happens when you use a training method for dogs to teach doctors? Answers to all those questions on my podcast, Hidden Brain.
Stacy, Danielle Kurtzleben.
So let me ask you a question.
Yes.
What was your first summer job?
Oh, that's easy. Babysitting. I started babysitting when I was about 10 years old. I took it very seriously. I had like a whole network of people. I was like a little babysitting. I took it really seriously.
You were a one-woman babysitter's club.
Oh, I was quite a mogul after a while because I was like this very overachieving babysitter.
You were known for being a babysitter.
I was in high demand. What about you? What was your first summer job?
You know, I thought you'd never ask. My first real summer job with W-2s and all of that was bussing tables at a restaurant and golf course. It was called The Barn. I was 14. The Barn is a refurbished barn, actually. So
where is it?
It's not just a clever name. It is in rural Iowa. But I knew I was going to be doing a story this week about teen summer jobs, so I had kind of a blast from the past. I called up The Barn, because it's still operating today, to see if I could talk to one of the teenagers working there now. And they told me there aren't any.
Really?
I called up the current owner, a guy named Mark Krull, and I asked him what's changed. You don't get a lot of applications from teenagers anymore?
Not really. We get some, but it seems like they're all so busy they can never work when we want them to work.
Right. Like they
work certain days or during the day. They want their nights and weekends off, and that's when we need people.
Is it just less of a norm now for teenagers to work than it used to be, like, back when I was a teenager or you were a teenager?
I think so. Yeah. Of course, there's a big difference between my time and your time, too.
I like Mark Krull.
Oh, he's great. I mean, fair enough, Mark. He is a little older than me, but this bummed me out. Like I was saying, everyone worked there. That said, maybe I shouldn't have been surprised, because what's happening at The Barn, as it turns out, is emblematic of a bigger shift in the labor market. There's just been this shift over the last few decades away from the summer job.
The number of teens who go out and get summer jobs has plummeted in the last few decades. And on top of that, it hasn't really picked up all that much since the Great Recession, even though unemployment on the whole is as low as it's been since 2000. So let's start off with a quick chart on the radio.
If you were to look at a chart of the employment rate for teenagers, now this is 16 to 19-year-olds, there are these regular sharp spikes upward. Now that spike is July. That's the month when teen employment peaks every year. And last July, nearly 37% of teenagers were working. That's not much, at least not if you compare it to past decades. Back in the 1980s and 1970s, there were a few summers where that teen employment rate was near 60%.
So it's approaching half of what it used to be. And even the size of those July spikes has gotten smaller. The summer employment bump has shrunk considerably over the last couple of decades. That is a big change since Paul Harrington had his first job.
So, quick question. What was your first, what did you do as a teen?
Well, I was a gas station attendant. I think I was about 14 then.
Today, Paul is a labor economist at Drexel University, and he has done a lot of research into youth unemployment.
So the labor market is really quite good for college grads, for pretty much everyone. I mean, these are really good times. You know, the big exception of that is teenagers. Teens are, you know, not doing very well. Their summer job outlook is not very good.
And there are a lot of reasons for this, and Paul walked me through some of them. The first big reason young Americans aren't working is older Americans.
Probably the most important thing is the change in behavior in the size and behavior of the older worker population. Lots and lots of older workers now are working in teen labor markets.
Americans are staying in the labor force longer and longer these days for a bunch of reasons. They're living longer, some people need more money to retire, others just want to work longer.
And given the choice between a 16-year-old and a 66-year-old, Paul says most employers will pick the latter.
You know, when you look at the demand side of things, it's very clear as that supply of older workers becomes available, employers clearly prefer them because employers really see older workers as having the basic kind of behavioral traits that they need, and they think that kids, you know, increasingly don't have those traits. You know, dependability, reliability, self-control.
In fact, Paul says teens just tend to be in the back of the job line. Right now, the teen unemployment rate is 12.8%. That is way higher than the total unemployment rate of 3.8%.
Right, but it's not historically high, and that's an important point here. This isn't all about employers not wanting to employ teens. It's also about teens not wanting to be employed.
I knew it was their
yep.
fault. In here somewhere. I'm just kidding.
You're going to get so many angry
Snapchats.
Emails.
I like teenagers. It was such a painful, awkward time.
It was. We feel you.
Oh,
but
I feel like it just takes me back to
cafeteria. But speaking
terrible.
Of life being stressful for teenagers, like, many have an incentive not to work. There's a reason they're not working every summer.
The higher education system now, I would argue, punishes high school kids for working because the rewards in high school for college admission are not work-related. They're, you know, community service, that sort of thing, and, you know, with respect to extracurricular activities.
Short version, to a lot of teenagers, waiting tables just is not going to look as good on a college application as, say, tutoring kids or playing three sports or doing summer academic programs or learning Russian or something.
And there's sort of a broader cultural aspect of this because as it becomes less of a thing for teens to work, fewer teens even consider working. It's just not the norm, kind of like Mark and I were talking about.
Also, we should just add, this phenomenon doesn't affect all teenagers equally. In fact, the teen job market is yet another area in which life is a little bit easier if you have a little more money.
Lower the family income, less likely a kid is to work. And as family income rises, you know, much higher probability for the child to work. And a lot of that's got to do with how the labor market works. You know, the way teens, young adults get jobs is through labor market's a social network. It's a social system.
I can't believe you need contacts now for a summer job. It's all about who you know, kid.
You know, you got to learn that early. But one thing I should add here is that the cause and effect kind of go both ways here, because aside from what Paul was saying, you know, rich kids might just be more likely to live in healthier economies where there are more jobs anyway. Likewise, lower income kids might live in an area with fewer jobs. So that also makes sense. To Paul, the decline in teens working is really bad news because teen jobs are important in giving people basic foundational work skills.
It's a way you develop proficiency. How do you learn behavioral traits? One of the ways you do it is you go behave. This is the first time that you're asked to act for almost everybody. It's the first time you're asked to act as an adult mm-hmm. in an adult setting where there are adult repercussions for your decisions, either positive or negative.
And Paul says delaying that economy-wide, especially across millions of kids, is going to create workforce-wide productivity problems. That's what he worries about.
But for people like Paul who really worry about this, I am happy to report that all is not lost. I found a teen summer worker. Of course, they still
Wonderful.
Exist. So I called up the swimming pool in Buffalo Center, Iowa. I figured if my old workplace didn't still have teens around, at least one of my friends might. And I got to talk to Krista Shutter. She is 18 years old. She just graduated from North Iowa High School. Go Bison. And this is her second summer lifeguarding at the Buffalo Center pool.
It's much more fun than I originally anticipated. I mean, I work with great people, and I enjoy the kids and their goofy comments and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, is that what you like most about it, is working with the kids?
Yeah, truth be told, I did not like kids growing up. Like, they just kind of scared me.
Krista was great. I mean, she actually took her time out of her day of lifeguarding. She was talking to me from the Buffalo Center pool office there. And she got over her phobia of kids, of course. Now she's lifeguarding. But she doesn't plan on making a career of this, of course. She's headed to college this fall.
Yeah, I'm going to go to Iowa State and major in animal science.
Cool. Are you going to be a veterinarian?
That's the goal.
Here's the thing. Working at the pool, Krista is not getting experience with dogs or horses or anything like that. But Paul says that actually doesn't matter.
Well, the first thing you see is that kids who work while they're in high school, they just are more likely to work as an adult. Okay, they have higher employment rates as adults than kids who don't work while they're in high school. Second thing is that as adults, 10 years later, they make somewhere between 10 and 20% more, holding other factors constant, than kids who didn't work.
So Krista's job now will make her higher earning, just a better worker down the line, Paul says. And even at age 18, Krista says she can see this happening herself. Do you feel like this is good job experience or prep for the real world?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm constantly interacting with parents and kids, and I think it's really helped my people skills.
Oh, there you go. Interacting.
I know.
She's wonderful.
So, Stacey Vanek-Smith, yes. All of those skills you developed babysitting, they've made you the reporter that you are now.
Yeah, it is similar somehow.
Wait a minute.
If you don't already subscribe to The Indicator, first of all, what are you waiting for? We post a new episode every weekday afternoon.
Sell it, Garcia.
Yeah, and it's like Planet Money, but it's shorter and better looking.
Definitely so much better looking.
Possibly even nerdier with more lame jokes. Did I say lame? I meant awesome.
Awesome jokes.
Yeah.
Last week, we went to a bar to watch the World Cup, and we traded some economic insights that came out of it. And we also got inside of what it looks like to do a big bank stress test.
We do it all.
We do it all. So subscribe, rate, review, do all the things. It is The Indicator from Planet Money.
Planet Money posts all episodes on Facebook. You can find us there. And if you have thoughts about this episode, leave a comment on the post.
It'll be read by data miners all over the world.
Oh, yeah. And you can also find us on Twitter and Instagram or email us at planetmoney@npr.org. The Indicator is produced by Darius Rafieyan.
I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith.
And I'm Cardiff Garcia. Thanks for listening.